This is the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm Howard Jacobson of PlantYourself.com. So, welcome to the future. Welcome to 2017. You have 10 days left, if you're listening to this on publication day, January 4th, for the Big Change Program. Doors close irrevocably on the 14th. You have 10 days to find out more about it. You can go to bigchangeprogram.com and do a test drive. You can send me an email, hj@plantyourself.com, and ask me questions. If you want 2017 to be the year that you want it to be, and you do, check it out. This might be the very thing. So, speaking of the future, today's guest is Hal Hirschfield. He's a UCLA psychology professor, and he has done some of the most interesting studies on the connection between how we think about the future and what we do right now. Not to give too much away, but basically, we have a part of our brain that thinks about us, that thinks about ourselves. And it turns out it's a different part of the brain than the one that thinks about other people. And here's the cool bit. For most of us, when we think about ourselves in the future, we're using the other folks part of the brain. So we actually think of ourselves in the future as a stranger. And like, seriously, who the hell wants to do random nice things for a stranger when it's going to cause us pain? Who's going to save for retirement for some stranger and not get the things we want to get now? Who's going to go running in the cold of January just so that some stranger can look good and be fit and happy and healthy? And who among us is going to say no to the eclairs and the donuts and the holiday binging just so some future self can get into their genes? The good news is we get to change our brains if we want to, and we get to do things that will help us view our future selves as less strangers and more like us. And when we do that, all of a sudden, all those things that we do that are uncomfortable now but will bear great rewards later become easier to do, more automatic, and almost like default behaviors. So I heard Hal on my friend Peter Bregman's podcast, where he was talking about ways in which we can use the future self concept to become better leaders. And today I talk with Hal about how we can use that future self concept to keep our vows to ourselves, to live healthy today so that we can be healthy and happy tomorrow. So without further ado, Hal Hirschfield, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
I discovered you through your appearance on Peter Bregman's Bregman Leadership Podcast. And as I wrote to you in sort of giddy excitement after, you know, I listen to podcasts while I run. So 6 miles out, I'm like, remember to call Hal. Remember to reach out to Hal.
And I'm impressed that you made it 6 miles through the podcast. That's good.
Well, I double and triple up, but it's funny. Like, I don't know if you ever listened to like something on the radio that's a repeat and you can remember exactly where you were when you heard it the first time.
Yes. Yes.
So as I run, I can remember like the mind blowing points, you know, that you made during that interview. And I'm like, oh gosh, what I need is a running secretary.
That's great.
Before we get into the topic itself, I'm really curious, like what's your journey? How you came to be interested in, you know, the things you're interested in, which include psychology, marketing, neuroscience, all that. Like, what was your journey?
That's a great question. So actually, it's been a while since I've sort of thought about my journey, but I guess I can say that my folks are both clinical psychologists. And so you can imagine I tried to do everything I could to not go into a psychology field, but I was very interested in political science, and I was adamant about taking that my freshman year of college, and I signed up for it, but I'm also not great with administrative tasks. And I signed up for a section that was conflicting with my other requirements. And this was back when there was no computer to sign up for things. And so I was in the room, and there the person in front of me pen and paper, and she said, well, the only thing that's open for you is social psychology. So I said, all right, I guess I'm taking that. And so that kind of put me down a journey of really getting interested in understanding how people think about and interact with the world and with others. And, you know, from there, I happened to be home for winter break and came across a American Psychologist journal that my parents had, and Laura Carstensen had an amazing article in there called Taking Time Seriously. And it was all about the emotional and motivational changes that happen when we have different time horizons in our life, when we think that we have a lot of time left versus not a lot of time left. And I, as a college sophomore, I reached out to her and we sort of had a correspondence, and then I ended up going to graduate school with her. And, you know, this is a person who's very interested in, you know, understanding the psychology of time preferences, but with an eye towards policy decisions and changes. And at some point in graduate school, she said, you know, we've got to talk about retirement. And I thought, what a weird thing for me to think about as like a 24-year-old, you know? And I realized in reading the literature and talking to her that so many of these decisions around retirement have to do with the way that we think about time and the way that we think about ourselves. And then what got really interesting is that, you know, we sort of collectively realized this isn't just about retirement. You know, that's one example. This is about all of these decisions that rely on self-control and having temptations now versus, you know, knowing what you should do in the future. And so it applies to health, it applies to eating, it applies to ethical decision making, it applies to environmental decisions. You know, all of these things sort of have these trade-offs between the now and future me. So that was kind of my journey in a nutshell. And then, you know, I tried to be kind of open-minded as to where my path would take me. And the work I was doing sort of ended up being, I think, you know, sort of most relevant to other business school academics rather than psychology academics. And so while I have a foot in both worlds now, I'm housed in a business school and I love it. It gives me contacts to the, you know, to companies and the outside world and to entrepreneurial business students who really go on to do some very cool things in the world. So that's how I got to where I am.
Cool. So I'm curious, do your parents find your stuff useful in their clinical practices?
Well, I'm an only child, so they find everything I do useful. But to some extent, you know, it's interesting that you asked that question because I never made the link to, you know, clinical issues, but, you know, because I don't see clinical patients, but my wife's also a clinical psychologist. So, you know, in talking to them, you realize a lot, you know, people have issues around these decisions that involve these trade-offs between now and later. And it's not just sort of financial and health, et cetera, but it's also other things like, you know, it plays into their mental health as well. And so I think it comes up for them, although, they don't often talk to me about the specifics.
All right. Well, so let's get into a little bit about, so you were fascinated by this idea of time horizons.
Yeah.
And how did you arrive at your own particular topic about sort of future self?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, I had just been reading, I'd sort of done what they say you should do, which is to, you know, dig into the literature, which I find the notion of being able to sit and read for a while so you know, idealistic now. It seems like the time is too frenzied to do that. But back when I was a graduate student, I was able to do that, and I came across a great article by a guy named Shane Frederick. He's now a professor at Yale in their business school, and he had sort of reviewed a lot of the different literature streams on how people make trade-offs between now and later. And he had read this philosopher named Derek Parfit, who put out some really provocative ideas in the 70s and 80s that are, I think, still being digested. This guy is one of the most influential living philosophers. And, you know, that reading that led me to read that work, and then that led me to read other work. And so I kind of took up this idea that I thought was very interesting of thinking about how people think about themselves over time as a way of looking at these long-term decisions, and how to understand where people go wrong and how to understand how to make them better.
So the basic idea of the research is that, at least, you know, the way you described it in the podcast and your TEDx talk, is that like our brains, I guess, like when we're little bitty infants, one of our first tasks is to figure out us from not us.
So that's right. So the basic idea, that's a piece of it. And I'll step back even a step further, if that's okay. I mean, the basic idea is trying to understand, basically, you know, why it is that we might say that we'll run more, eat healthier, save more money, et cetera, but then we don't do it. And, you know, part of the answer to that comes from the fact that we're always faced with these temptations in the present that make it really hard to say no to things right now. They're more colorful and interesting and emotionally evocative. And then, you know, in the future, it's going to be, well, I'll take care of it then. I think that's kind of the thought that a lot of us have. And so the basic idea that underlies a lot of my work and my students' work is this sense that the self takes on many different flavors over time. And so we've got our current self, and then, you know, we have some future self that will be privy to the decisions that we make now. But in many ways, we might feel sort of emotionally disconnected from that future self. We might feel, and this is really just like kind of a metaphor, but we might feel like that future self is almost another person, and another person whom we, you know, maybe we care about, maybe we don't care about, but we're maybe not paying attention to their interests in the way that we possibly should. And so that was kind of our starting point there. Now the neuroscience stuff that you bring up, that was, you know, some research that we had done where we were saying, well, you know, we know that the brain can essentially categorize what's me and what's not me. And our suggestion was, well, you know, if the future self to some extent is seen like it's not me, like it's another person, maybe we'll see a similar sort of pattern of brain activity when people think about themselves in the future, you know, in the same way as they think about other people now. And that was, you know, I'm glossing over a lot of the details here, and I can certainly send the academic papers out, but, you know, the gist is that across the board from our research participants, on average, you know, the neural activity that was sort of evoked by thinking about the future self was very similar to the neural activity that was evoked to thinking about another person.
Right. And I guess the reason I started with that, I sort of jumped the gun a little bit, is no. So I, you know, true confessions, I've been flirting for the past week and a half with mm-hmm. with evolutionary psychology,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
which I mm-hmm. both love and loathe.
Yep, I understand. Yeah.
And I think I love it because it's so interesting and it tells such a good story. And you look at a behavior and you can say, well, you know, if you were, you know, why was that useful in Stone Age time? But it, you know, one of my critiques is that it's really deterministic. Like the brain has these modules, you know, the same way you'd put software into a computer, and like, you know, this one does word processing and that one does, you know, evaluating your mate, you know, breast size and all of these things.
Yep.
But like what I wanted to bring out is like one of the key functions of the brain, you know, it's not like I have a part of the brain that's devoted to figuring out how far my mouth should be from the microphone, but I do have a part of my brain that's dedicated to helping the infant figure out me from the rest of the world, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I think, so just to back up, you know, I share some of your exact same feelings. You know, I think that there's a lot of theory and empirical work in evolutionary psychology that's provocative and interesting. You know, the difficulty is that, as you said, it's reductionist, and it's also determinist, right? And it's hard to falsify to some extent. But, you know, I think there's ideas there that are interesting. Now, we never went so far as to say, you know, growing up, the brain needs to distinguish between what's me and what's not me. And now I think, at the risk of sort of speculating too much, because I frankly am not an expert in the evolutionary psych literature. I'm guessing that there's somebody out there who would say that's not a bad quality to have, to at least be able to distinguish between, well, maybe not so much me and not me, but sort of like the people who are providing to me and the people who are not providing to me. You know, I could imagine that being an evolutionary quality that's necessary. But, you know, as to when this develops, this idea of like separating the self from others and the self from the future self, that to me is a fascinating open question that I don't really know the answer to. And I'm not sure others do as well.
Right. So, let's get into the basics, because I have all these questions about like time. I read this book, I think it was in the early 90s, that I was found really fascinating, called The Geography of Time.
Yeah, no, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I've got it right here in my office. Robert Levine.
Yeah, yeah. And okay. It looked at, basically different mores and approaches and really mindsets about time around the world and how different they are and how, you know, so and so much of like psychology research is done on, you know, U.S. undergrads.
Yep.
But, you know, so that, you know, like there are languages that have different tenses that we do. So like, what are there some sort of universal, basic, common understandings about time that that people share?
Oh, man, that is such an interesting question. You know, so I think I the stuff you're referencing there is fascinating work. So, the what we know at this point is, first off, there's different languages around the world. I think you're just referencing that. And that's actually from a colleague of mine, Keith Chen, here at UCLA's business school. That work suggests that the way that people speak about time actually changes the way that they think about time. So that, you know, there's some languages that have a strong division between the present and the future. So English is one of those languages, right? Where we are very clear when something's happening in the future, we change the verb, we change the words around it. But there are other languages where we talk about the present and we talk about the future in similar ways. So German is a language like that. And that also suggests that the speakers of these different languages have different ways of thinking about how separate the present is from the future and how much one blends into the other. Mm. Then there's other really interesting cultural findings that suggest that, you know, whereas you and I probably very sort of, you know, almost innately think about the past flowing into the future, call it from, you know, left to right, like if you were to draw this out, speakers of other languages that are not read left to right, like Hebrew, think about it actually flowing in different direction, or Mandarin, which might go up and down, you know, they think about it not left to right, but up and down. And so I think there are fascinating differences between the way that time is encoded around the world, which is to some extent tied to language. Keith Chen, that's the guy here, and Lara Boroditsky, who's at UC San Diego, do some fascinating work in that topic. So to be able to speak to commonalities across cultures around the world, you know, man, that's a really interesting question. It's a tough one. I mean, it's something I'd love to look at. Well, you know, we sort of started with, you got to start somewhere, and we started with the U.S. population. I would, you know, I'll note that we sort of expanded beyond undergrads, but, you know, you can start there too because they're easier to get, right?
Yep.
But, you know, we sort of started with a very real policy problem of retirement savings and healthy eating, both of which are huge problems in a U.S.-based population. But, you know, were I to be based in Australia where there's very high saving rates as a function of government pensions, I don't think it would be, that would not be the sort of driving issue that would motivate the research. You know, so I think there's different ways to think about these questions as they apply around the world. But as to the universalities of time perception, oof, that's a tough one, but I like it.
or maybe, I mean, guess what I'm thinking as someone, like, yeah. I come at this from someone who's trying to help people eat healthier, exercise
sure.
more, live better, you know, not so much the financial, but the sort of lifestyle aspects
yep.
of
yep.
of that. And I think, you know, so what you said about people who speak Hebrew thinking about time flowing from right to left, or Mandarin from you know, down to up or up to down, lets me think that maybe language is a really key lever, like an interventional tool, because it's not just how time gets encoded in language, but it seems like language is sort of like a that language is how we translate time.
I think that's a very good interpretation of it. I think that's exactly right. And, you know, I think that, you know, there's sort of subtle tricks there where, you know, there's some very interesting work around, you know, language and motivation and time. There's a colleague of mine, a friend of mine named Chris Bryan, who does some really interesting work that looks at, you know, when we talk about an action, whether we talk about it in a verb form or a noun form. So if I say something like, I eat healthy versus I'm a healthy eater, those are, you know, they essentially mean the same thing, but the healthy eater, that's the noun form, that then ties into my identity and is wrapped up into, you know, sort of every aspect of my being. Whereas I eat healthy, that's a verb. It's not really linked to my identity. That's kind of more about, well, I occasionally eat healthy, I occasionally don't. And so he's found in voting context and cheating context, if you say things like, you know, I'm a voter versus I vote, you see differential effects on people's behavior. And so you can think about these sorts of things applied to the domain of time and motivation, healthy eating, et cetera, and how they might matter there too. And again, that's a subtle language difference that really could, you know, affect behavior.
Yeah. So there's, I'm just making a little note about what I want to come back to, but I feel like I've led you off into the weeds vis-a-vis my listeners who still don't exactly know what the hell we're talking about.
No, that's fine.
So I want to sort of bring it back to the basics, and because I'm just so fascinated to, because I feel like we've had this conversation because I've listened to your interview with Peter so many times. You know, it's like the, you know, like, you meet the celebrity and you know all about them. So let's. So the idea is that we have this. We all have presumably a future self, as long as we have a future, and to the extent to which we see this, or our brain perceives the future self as a different person, or less us, or less like top of mind, the way like in the moment, like my entire brain is just going like, gimme, 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 what can I get here for me?
Right.
Like
right.
I don't have that same relationship with the future self. And so as a result, we end up satisfying the needs of the immediate present self. So, you know, giving into temptation, and we don't do things like save or eat healthy. So what was the, it seems kind of obvious when you think about it that way. So what was the research questions that you followed to kind of tease that out and find sort of, you know, useful information and useful interventions around it?
That's great. You know, I think you're right. So when you say it sort of like, well, it's this trade-off between the present self and the future self, and I agree, it, you know, it does make sense. what we wanted to, you know, so our first research question was, could the way that people think about the future self, that is, let me put that a different way, how connected they are to them, how similar they feel to that future self, how sort of emotionally bonded they feel with that future self, if that makes sense. What we wanted to first know is, could that relationship be related to or be linked to the types of decisions people make in terms of trading off smaller rewards now against larger rewards later, which is sort of at the crux of these types of issues that we're talking about. But really what we wanted to see was, could that relationship explain our behavior above and beyond other sort of standard things like, you know, how much education do we have? How old are we? How much do we make per year, et cetera? And so, you know, the idea is, if our relationship with our future self could explain our decisions over time, but it couldn't explain those decisions any better than anything else, then it's not really that worthwhile to study, because you might as well go for something easier. But if, you know, if this relationship to our future selves could account for some explanatory power in our decisions over time, then that suggests that maybe that's a lever we could push and pull to get people to make decisions that fall more in line with the things that they say they want to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So whether you could actually change their behavior by changing their relationship to their future self.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's exactly right. And so, you know, to say, you know, look, there's all sorts of things that we've tried to do from an intervention standpoint to get people to say, save more, eat healthier, or not smoke, et cetera. And, you know, I guess at the very basic level, what we're trying to say is, could this be another route that is worth exploring? Could trying to get people to consider their future selves and think about their relationship with those future selves in a deeper way, could that be a route that's worth exploring? And that essentially was the starting point for our approach here.
Gotcha. So what was the first experiment that you did that led you to think that, like, I've got something here, this is really interesting?
Yeah. You know, the first one that we did was actually the neuroscience one that we were talking about earlier, which, you know, in retrospect was maybe an ambitious way to start, but, you know, you never can sort of predict how these things take off. And I, you know, I think at the time I was in a class where I had to propose a neuroscience project, and that seemed like a fun one. And I was lucky enough to have a supportive mentoring team who encouraged, you know, me and my colleagues to take that question on. And so that the first study that we really looked at was saying, okay, what happens in the brain when people think about themselves in the future, and could we use that neural activity to predict the decisions people make? And so, you know, what we had done is we said, well, does the future self essentially, you know, quote unquote, look like another person in the brain? And does the extent to which it looks like another person, is that predictive of these sorts of trade-off decisions that people make? So in that particular study, we gave people these choices between rewards that they could get right now that were small in nature versus rewards that they would have to wait for, but that were larger, which to me is like the you know, a good representation of saving for the future or eating healthy, all these things. It's like, well, I could take a smaller amount of money now and buy something, or I could wait over time and let that money grow, or I could, you know, I could eat a donut right now and that's rewarding, or I could wait over time and, you know, be much healthier, right? And so what we found is that the more people thought about the future self as another person, the more it sort of looked like a dissimilar other in the brain, if we can say that, the more impatient people were in these decisions that they were making that traded off these current rewards versus the future rewards. So in other words, you know, the sort of basic idea there was that, look, if there is that separation between the current self and the future self, that was at least predictive of the types of decisions that people make when they were trading off rewards now versus rewards later. And you know, we followed it up with a very like basic pen and paper survey where we asked people just to tell us, you know, how similar and emotionally connected do you feel to your future self? And we gave them kind of a visual scale. It was like a series of overlapping circles where we just said, you know, which group of circles in terms of their overlap best represents how you feel about your future self. And we use those answers to then predict, again, these decisions on these trade-off tasks. We use the answers on the circles measure to predict how much money people had accrued over time, so what their assets were over time. And again, what we found is that, you know, the closer people felt to their future selves, the more they had saved over time, the more patient they were on these laboratory tasks, et cetera. So that was kind of the starting point for us, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So are you saying that if you looked at someone's paper and pen survey about which set of overlapping circles they chose, that you would then have a predictive, a sense of what their brain activity would look like, and vice versa, that there was a...
Well, that's a good question. So I can't go quite that far, because what we never did was say, use their pen and paper responses on their, you know, to say what their future selves were like and map that onto the brain activity. You know, what we did is say, let's take the brain activity and use that to predict how patient people were on these financial tasks.
Gotcha.
But what you're asking is slightly different, but I just want to make sure I don't, you know, overstep what we did, but it's a great question.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, from there, the question is really, you know, there's sort of deep questions of where does this come from? Where does this tendency to see the future self as another person come from, which is, you know, sort of what you were getting at earlier with the evolutionary question, right? And so then you say, you know, what's the origin of this sort of propensity to see our future selves as another person? And then we also say, how can we change the state of affairs by making people feel closer to their future selves in an effort to get them to make better decisions?
Right. So when I hear that, I mean, so again, you know, I've been like steeped in the evolutionary biology. So I'm hearing little echoes in my brain saying, well, you know, maybe the whole thing is that there is no innate concept of future self. Like that's just something that we've made up, you know, recently, and and that, you know, that any animal in its natural environment is just following algorithms that are designed to get to, you know, survival and reproduction. And so the problem is not the future self concept, but
right.
We're in this really mismatched environment in which the things we would normally do, like, oh, look, calories, like eating huge amounts of calories made perfect sense for your future self if you were in, you know, a Stone Age famine.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, the statistic is that, you know, I think it's more years have been added on the average life expectancy in the last 120 years or so than in all of the previous millennia combined. You know, and so you think about that, I think what that suggests is that basically from an evolutionary standpoint, in the blink of an eye, we have drastically increased how long people live on average. And so when people were used to living to 40 or 35 or something like that, the idea of being able to sock away things for later or deeply consider the golden years of retirement was a completely foreign, and I mean, to some extent it would have been irrational, right? To say, well, don't live for today, live for tomorrow. You know, who knows? I know. I'm going to live to 30 and then die because that's what happens, right? And so to all of a sudden have this extra time that hadn't previously been accounted for, I think what you said is a really good way to put it. It creates somewhat of a mismatch environment where we're sort of evolutionarily primed to do the things that will matter for us right now and in the very short term, when in reality, you know, in order to sort of have a healthy, productive, long life, we shouldn't be thinking that way, or we should be thinking less that way, right? And I think that's a really deep insight that you're raising there.
Well, so then, you know, you've got these neural images, which when I first heard about it, it's like some part of me was like, oh, that's so sexy that you can actually, you know, that this isn't just sort of like philosophy or theory. That's like, oh yeah, you know, the brain says so. We've got imaging, and of course, I think there's, you know, there's a danger with that too. Like if all of a sudden someone would come out with a $399 iPhone app that would allow you to image your brain, then half of the people would see themselves on the more dissociated half of the bell curve and say, well, that explains why.
Yeah.
I can't, you know, so is, do you?
I think, well, what you're raising is a fascinating conversation, because first off, the couple things there jumped out. One is that, you know, I think you're right, right? So anytime you throw a brain image onto something, you know, it seems sexier. And in fact, there's some really interesting research suggesting that people are more likely to believe the exact same research finding if you pair it with a picture of a brain than if you don't, because it's just like, well, it must be, you know, well, it must be real. It must be happening on a biological level. And so I think, you know, as consumers of research, you know, we have to be very careful to try to understand what's happening, what the study was, and what the neuroscience is sort of is saying. But beyond that, you know, you're raising this other point of taking a kind of reductionistic approach to behavior, of saying, you know, if I say, oh, look at that, my brain looks like that, that explains everything. Well, that's a really weird notion. I mean, it really sort of robs people of their agency, and, you know, sets up one of these, you know, sort of sci-fi scenarios of predetermination, and are we destined to act a certain way? You know, do the brains of killers look different than the brains of non-killers, et cetera? And are you, you know, destined to do that? And the, you know, the reality is, of course, I think that there's, you know, we have some agency over our decisions, and we do control impulses, and we do exert willpower and self-control at times in our lives. And so, you know, if you couple that notion with the idea that there's also a concept of brain plasticity, the idea that, or maybe I should say phenomenon rather than concept, but the idea that the brain can change over time and new connections are constantly being made and formed and strengthened. And, you know, what we haven't done, but what I would love to do is to say, you know, if we could somehow have an intervention that makes people feel closer to their future selves, more connected to their future selves, would we see the effects of such an intervention on a neural level as well? You know, I think to me that would be a fascinating thing to do, and someone's got to give me some money to do it, because it would be an expensive study, you know, but...
We'll crowdsource it on the podcast.
That's great. Thanks very much.
Yeah. I mean, it makes me think of, I don't know if he's your colleague, Jeffrey Schwartz.
No.
Who wrote the Mind and the Brain?
Oh yeah. I haven't read the book, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. But I mean, he talks about this idea that the mind can change the brain, and
right.
he uses his own example of, you know, seeing these destructive neural circuits around certain parts of the brain related to obsessive compulsive disorder. And by training people to recognize that these impulses to wash or count tiles or whatever are faulty signals from the brain, not only do they get some freedom from it, but in subsequent neural imaging, those circuits are damped down. The mind can actually affect the molecules and the neurons and the synapses and the atoms in the living tissue.
Yeah, it's fascinating work. You're right. I forgot. He's at UCLA, right? He's at the med school here. It's fascinating work. And I think that is, you know, there's something hopeful about that, and in almost the opposite of these reductionistic ways of thinking about ourselves and our biology, if you will. But, you know, when it comes to at least thinking about the self over time, you know, we haven't done the research necessary to say an intervention of a given form could actually change the way that not only we think about the future self, but the way that the brain encodes the future self. And I think that would be it's a fascinating study to think about.
Right. But you have done studies where you've looked at interventions on and their effects on behavior, right? On the stuff that normal people care about, like, are they going to have enough money when they retire? Are they going to be morbidly obese at age 60? That sort of thing, right?
That's right. You know, so we've done a variety of studies that look at these interventions, you know, one of which one sort of set of interventions has shown people age progressed images of themselves and looked at how that affects their financial decisions, ethical decisions. We're currently looking at this in a weight loss domain. And we've also run out where we have people write letters to their future selves, very, very low tech, but I think sort of harkens back to what you were saying earlier, that, you know, the future self to some extent is a, you know, a construction of late. And I think that's exactly the idea, that it's something that we're kind of not really used to thinking about. And so just getting people to sit down and put pen to paper and say, you know, dear future self, what's my life like now? What will my life be like in the future? It's an exercise that kind of prompts people to at least start considering that there's another person on the other side of the divide between now and the future.
So what have you found when you have people write the letter or look at the age progressed image?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, this is, I would say, even though we've been doing it for a couple of years, you know, the work is still in its infancy, and that we're still trying to find natural field settings where we can test these ideas in. But, you know, the basic idea is what we found is that showing people these age progressed images has at least made them more willing to save for the future, whether it's more willing to increase their 401k contribution in a hypothetical scenario, or more willing to allocate more money to a long-term savings fund. We've also found in the sort of ethical domain, we ran a study with teenagers in the Netherlands who, you know, one group of them, basically, we had a bunch of these high school students, and we created a new Facebook friend for them. And half of them became friends with a version of themselves today. It was sort of like they had to, you know, talk to themselves. And another half of them became Facebook friends with an older version of themselves. So they actually, you know, we created this profile where they had this, you know, older future self in there. And we tracked them for a week, and we looked at their propensity to engage in sort of unethical behavior. So this is, or delinquent behavior. So, you know, I'm not talking about selling, you know, large quantities of drugs or murdering people, when I'm talking about things like cheating on a test or shoplifting or sort of, you know, smaller crimes of, you know, well, crimes or at least unethical things. And, you know, and we found that the students who had seen and become friends with their future selves were more likely to act in these, you know, call it more ethical ways, more long-term oriented ways, you know, that's a real behavior situation, which I really, really liked. I'm sorry about that. You know, so I was saying that's a real behavior that I think is meaningful. And so we're following this work up by looking at other scenarios and other domains and other, you know, what we call moderators, you know. So right now we're looking at this in a weight loss scenario where we're showing people images of themselves in the future, changing weight as a function of behavior. And one of the questions we're asking is, does it matter how healthy you are right now? You know, I'm not sure that we would expect an intervention that makes you look a little bit thinner to really matter to someone who's already pretty fit. But if you are overweight or obese, then you might see more of an effect on intentions and behaviors as a result of these sorts of interventions.
Yeah, that's so interesting because, you know, one of the things I do is I work with people who are overweight and obese. And right. I've got, you know, you're probably familiar with some of the data from the National Weight Control Registry and, you know, just how unlikely it is for anyone to lose even 5% of their body weight and keep it off for even,
so tough.
Even 2 years. And, you know, in my community, the sort of plant-based community where people are eating a really ideal optimal diet, and then we get them exercising. Like, I've got a bunch of friends who have all lost 200 pounds or more.
Oh my gosh.
And they're, you know, so I'll get their before and after pictures and I'll give a lecture and I'll put it up there. And, you know, they're extremely inspiring. But one of the things that my friends who are, you know, who are these people have to constantly tell other people is, I'm not special. I'm not amazing. I didn't do anything you couldn't do. And, you know, to be able to then take a picture of someone who's 430 pounds and show them what they would look like, you know, it feels 10 times more powerful than showing them this this sort of, you know, bevy of you know, transformation that I'm using now.
Yeah, I guess my response would be that there's probably a mixture of interventions that would work, you know? And so one of the things we don't know is who responds better to what sort of intervention, right? Because I can imagine some of the stuff that you're talking about and doing could be, you know, quite useful to some people. And I could imagine that a more image-based intervention like what I'm talking about could be useful to another type of group of people. And trying to figure out who responds better to what is a task for future researchers or current uncover.
Right. And I guess another thing is that some of the people I've talked to who have gone on these tremendous journeys say now that if you had told them when they started where they'd be now, they would have quit because it would have seemed too unbelievable.
Exactly. And I think, you know, when you then have this unrealistic contrast, I think, you know, that can be almost unmotivating for people, or or you can even think about that in another context where you say something like, saving small amounts of money right now will eventually get you to your goal. Well, it's like, if I see that, you know, I put in $10 this month and my goal is to save $100,000, you know, it's like, oh God, it's just a drop in the bucket and it's not doing anything. And it's easy to just kind of drop out, you know? But I'd say that, you know, helping people sort of see the path or at least stay focused on how what they're doing right now is continuing them on that path. That's where you might see a real effect on, you know, a positive effect on behavior.
Right. Do you distinguish between sort of the ongoing behaviors, right? The don't eat the cheeseburger versus the one time, you know, allocate more to your 401k. It seems like it would be easier to sort of hit people up strategically with a poignant picture of their future self and then have them do one thing that locks it in.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. And I think, you know, we've distinguished between those, but not in a sort of rigorous way where we can say, look, interventions work better in this context and not that context. And I think the issue that you're bringing up is that, say, with the 401k decision, to some extent, that is a one-shot decision, right? So I go in, I start my new job or it's my open enrollment period. I make my choice and I don't normally change it because people are so, you know, inherently, you know, they're just not they're slightly lazy and not motivated to get in there and deal with their finances. And so I think the median number of changes that people make to their retirement accounts is zero, because it's like you make your election and then you let it go. But with eating, I mean, this is a decision we make multiple times a day, right? And so to if I were to show you an image of yourself in the future every time you made an eating decision, I'm not sure that that would really be, I think over time you would end up kind of immune to it, or you would become what we call habituated to it. So I think you could still consider, though, the relevance of these types of interventions in a health domain, not in terms of the everyday behavior, but in terms of the signing you up to come to the table and, enroll in a program or enroll in a diet or whatever it is to start that process. That might be where these sorts of interventions matter more, or are at least more effective. But that, that's a speculation and something that we're still trying to figure out how to discuss in the literature and how to write about.
Right. It suddenly occurred to me that maybe another form of that is what you were talking about at the top of the call, around the difference between eating and being an eater. That if you can use future self to get someone to kind of jiggle and then refix their self-identity, that could have sort of cascading long-term
effects. Absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. And it's, again, not something that we've investigated yet, but something I think would be really interesting to investigate. I think it's a great call.
Cool. So now we've got two crowdsourced studies to work on.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I think as you're pointing to, there's a lot of future directions for this work. And I think it's made a lot of good progress so far to say, this is another way of looking at how and why people fail to make decisions that fall in line with the things that they say they want to do. But there's still a lot left to be done to figure kind of what situations matter, where might we have more lift from these interventions and not, and who might be more or less affected by these sorts of interventions. Because I think, that to me is the really difficult sort of policy prescription to understand, because, I would never go out and say, here's a way to affect behavior across the board, show everybody an image of themselves in the future, or anything else, because people are different and people are individuals and people respond differently to different types of messages. And I think we need to just figure out what segments respond better to one sort of message than another. And, that can really, that I think can really help us help people make better decisions over time.
Right. I think that's so much of a more utopian future than, like, I was starting to fantasize about, like, the future self pill. Like, you figure out how to give someone a psychoactive drug that fires up all their future self connection.
You joke, or maybe not, but I mean, look, there's some really interesting research coming out right now on the beneficial use of mushrooms, of psilocybin.
Yeah.
And, I think one of the things that we know that they do from previous research is they help sort of break down boundaries, psychological boundaries. And so, could you have people take a dose and have an easier time stepping into the minds of their future selves and even the minds of others, And I think that's, it seems futuristic, but then again, who knows?
Futuristic or 10,000 years old.
Yeah. Well, that's another way to think about it.
Yeah.
That's funny. That's right.
I mean, not that I know anyone who's done magic mushrooms or ayahuasca, but I've heard that.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
That, people often sort of fast forward their lives to the moment of their death.
Yes.
And I know,
yes.
And sort of like the Tibetan culture, there's the whole Grateful Dead thing that was, the purpose of your life is to be at peace at the moment of your death. I guess there are cultures that think about their deaths a lot, which is, a form of your future self or non-self.
Absolutely. It's a, I just actually wrote a chapter with a colleague of mine, Dan Bartels, and we were sort of trying to put out some of the things that we think would be interesting in the future. And one of them is exactly what you're talking about. You know, death is a form of future self, but not, but it kind of breaks down. You know, depends on, do we see the self as the entity that exists after death, et cetera. And I don't think this is just a theoretical question, because so many important end of life policy decisions rely on people having to think about dying, which is something that most people shy away from. And, you know, there is a lot of behaviors and relationships that would be improved if people could sit down and decide on an end-of-life plan, decide on a will, decide on whether they're going to buy a longevity annuity, you know, all of these sorts of things that to some extent involve projecting oneself forward to either the time of death or after death and what will happen to my loved ones. And, you know, I think these are, to me, that's sort of the next frontier of questions that I think are important to ask, both from a theoretical standpoint and from a research perspective, a practical practical research and practical policy perspective.
That's so interesting, because earlier in the year I attended a workshop with I guess I'd call him a sort of shaman from Canada, Stephen Jenkinson, who wrote a book called Die Wise. And, you know, he's sort of, you know, all he says, like, Western civilization, we are basically a death-denying culture. And because we're so scared of death, We've created all these forms of, like, death within life. We, you know, we destroy the environment. We are terrible to each other. The, you know, it's just that healthy societies have a healthy regard for death and a consciousness of it.
I couldn't agree more. You know, and I think it also stems. It's also related to other sorts of decisions in society where. A healthy regard toward death may also be related toward a healthy regard toward the elderly. A healthy regard toward the elderly might be related toward a healthy approach to retirement and other old age issues. You know, I think these things are cousins, if not siblings, and need to be treated as such.
Hmm. Wow, this is such a deep field. So one more little set of questions, just... So I started thinking about sort of future self, not in those terms, but upon reading a primer on behavioral economics by a guy named Bob Neese. It's called The Power of 50 Bits. And he talks a lot about hyperbolic discounting.
Yep.
Which essentially is what you're talking about, that we would rather have something now than a much better something in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read that chapter on hyperbolic discounting, I kind of despaired. Because it seems like the math was just so badly against us. It's like, you know, going to Las Vegas and, to a really crooked casino. Like, there's really no reasonable chance. And so I looked around and I found a concept put forth by Dan Ariely at Duke of benign masochism. And the way I understand it is sort of you take pleasure in your current pain. So instead of saying, I'm going to work out like an MF because I want to be ripped in 6 months or 2 years, or I'm going to eat I'm going to eat really healthy so I can be, you know, dancing at my grandchildren's wedding when I'm 70, that you actually try to take pleasure in your self-denial right now. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts or, you know, research on that.
I think it's a fascinating, I mean, Dan is one of the most creative, fascinating guys I know. And, you know, the concept, I think, is related to a couple of other ones, one of which is the idea that we might be better off dealing with negative emotions and negative events in our lives if we are to couple them with positive things. So, trying to essentially confront the negative alongside something positive. So we can reward ourselves. We can work out, and like you said, we can do it because it's going to be, make us ripped in the future, or we can work out because when we go to the gym, we get to watch an episode of Narcos on Netflix while we're on the elliptical. And so we're taking some pleasure while we work out, and it's coupling, you know, something positive with something slightly negative. That's some work by Katie Milkman from Wharton. And I think what Dan's talking about is something a little bit different, which is it's almost a meta awareness of the pain of doing something and sort of reveling in that.
Yeah.
It's getting pleasure and saving for the future because saving for the future might be something that's good to do, or getting pleasure in working out because working out is something that's good to do. It's a mindset shift that I think is difficult to implement, but nonetheless could be a useful thing to do. But I do feel like it falls under this broader class of interventions and decisions that sort of asks people to couple positive with negative.
Right. So is that what you were writing about in your 2013 paper, When Bad Can Be Good?
Yeah, actually, that's right. We were, you know, I have a couple papers where we looked at what happens when people are prone to experience the positive alongside the negative. In that particular instantiation, we looked at the propensity to experience mixed emotions. And the idea there was that being able to experience the negative alongside the positive would be related to improved mental health over time and to a better physical health and at least attenuated decreases in physical health. In other words, suggesting everybody's health declines over time, but could we sort of reduce that decline if over time people are more likely to experience negative stressful events in the face of positive ones as well? And so that's what we looked at in those papers there. But yeah, that's exactly right. That's where I was sort of going with that interpretation there.
That's beautiful too, because, you know, there's so much sort of pop psychology around just, you know, affirmations, be happy, focus on the positive.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, it doesn't seem to be very realistic when you look at sort of, you know, happy, successful aging populations around the globe. You know, they're not denying the pain and suffering and sadness of life.
That's right. I think that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Well, this has been a real pleasure, Howard. It's such an interesting conversation.
Yeah, I'm so grateful for you to take the time, and I, you know, there's I can't wait. You know, I'm following your research career. I find, you know, the questions you're asking and the ways you're asking them to be so creative and magical. You know, I've been following Dan Ariely's work for a long time, and I'm just blown away by his ability to ask really interesting questions and figure out how to ask them in the world. And I feel the same way about your work, and I'm so grateful for it and so happy that you took the time today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, and I really appreciate you reaching out. Hopefully we'll cross paths again and stay in touch in the future.
Well, my future self is counting on it.
And mine as well.
Thanks so much, Hal.
Take care.
Bye-bye. If you enjoyed this episode of the Plant Yourself podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Big Change Program led by me and Josh Lajani, visit bigchangeprogram.com. And be sure to check out the show notes for today's episode with links to the studies we talked about at plantyourself.com/191. So this morning, I just finished an interview with Ellen Jaffe Jones, veg coach, author of Vegan Fitness for Mortals, Paleo Vegan, and Vegan on $4 a Day, and she wanted me to let you know that she is doing Facebook Live cooking demonstrations in January, focusing on weight loss, healthy eating and weight loss, and those are at Wednesdays at 3 p.m., and you can find her on Facebook at Ellen Jaffe, J-A-F-F-E-E, Jones. You can also go to facebook.com/vegcoach, and you can see what she's up to, and she will be on this podcast in about a month. If you're new to the show, you can catch up on 190 archived episodes over at plantyourself.com, which is Plant Yourself Podcast Central. And while you're there, sign up for my weekly email newsletter. You'll get notifications about shows. You'll get articles that I write, other cool stuff. So let's talk about money for a minute. those of you who've been longtime listeners to the show know that this is self-funded. I don't take advertising. I don't do joint venture deals with my guests whereby I get some money if you go buy their stuff. Basically, I fund it through everything else I do in the world and by donations. I have some very loyal fans who give me money every month through Patreon or through PayPal. A bunch of other people send one-time donations, either digitally or by mail sometimes. And I also occasionally promote things that I'm doing in the world that I think you'd be interested in, especially the Big Change Program and other courses that I teach. And maybe I'm being a little bit too purist about this, but I've never had any interest in getting sponsors. You know, maybe some company like Vitamix came along and said, we'd like to sponsor you, or Instant Pot, or someone where, you know, I totally wholeheartedly use and recommend the products. You know, even Vitamix, like I'm getting away from smoothies, doing less and less of that. And I wonder, what if I am sponsored by Instant Pot and I'm leaning on them and all of a sudden I decide I want to go raw? Am I going to be able to have the guts to do it when my sponsor is Instant Pot? But when I listen to other podcasts that I like, I really enjoy the part where the podcaster promotes some product that's sponsoring the show. So I'd like to do that too. But my products are all going to be made up, so I hope you'll bear with me. Today's show is sponsored by the Tantibowl. Research out of Cornell from Dr. Brian Wansink suggests that the size of the bowl or plate or utensil that we use while we eat will determine how much we eat. Therefore, I've invented the Tantibowl. It's a soup bowl with little holes in it. You put your soup in there and it disappears before you can get too full. You can find out more at tantibowl.com. Today's episode is also sponsored by the Schnozhoover. The Schnozhoover is the world's first portable battery-operated vacuum cleaner for your nose. That's right, no more squeezing, no more poking, no more scrubbing. Three quick passes with the Schnozhoover and you're good to go. That was kind of fun. Seriously now, thanks to the real Plant Yourself podcast patrons, Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Anthony Disson, Brittany Porter, Dominic Marrow, Elizabeth Clifton, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Alan Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Christine Nielsen, Tina Scharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Velkanovsky, David Bizek, The Mysterious Michelle X, Elspeth Feldman, Victoria Dolomanova, Leah Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Landry, Josina, Julianne Rowland, Stu Dolnick, Sarah Durkis Rhymes with Circus, Kelly Cameron, Wayne Pedersen, Leanne Peterson, Janet Selby, Claire Adams, and Tom Franzak for your generous support of the podcast. Thanks also to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song, Sabali Don, Dance of Peace. You can find more of Will's beautiful music at his website, willridenour.com. And if you would like to support the show, you can, of course, share this and other episodes on social media via email. You can write that review on iTunes. Pretty please. That helps so much. And you can become a patron by pledging a one-time amount or ongoing gift to the podcast over at plantyourself.com. In garden news, I have to admit to being a bit lazy and unfocused, and we have crop covers over our produce, so I haven't been going out as much. We've got some beautiful kale and mustard greens, and I've been relying on stuff from the freezer and the fridge, so I'm going to use this as a reminder to get me out to that backyard this afternoon, pick some greens, and put them in all the dishes we cook over the next couple of days. In running news, everything's going pretty good. I had a terrible run on Sunday. I was supposed to do 8 1-mile at 7:30 pace, which is a little bit faster. Well, it's a lot faster than my marathon pace. I managed to get 5 miles in, and then I just didn't have anything else. And even when I was trying, I was at 8.5, 9 miles. So something just gave out. And it's interesting because this was really the very, very first, you want to call it, failed workout, where I just couldn't do the thing that I'd set out to do. So instead, I just, luckily I'd run the first 6 miles out, so I had to come all the way back. So I ended up doing about 14 miles. It was wet, it was raining, it was cold. I was wearing sweats that were kind of clingy, but none of those really make sense to me. So I have to start asking people who've been doing this for a while, what do you do, what happens, what does it mean when you have a workout that you just can't complete? If you have thoughts or ideas about that, please feel free to share them in the comment section of today's show, plantyourself.com/191. I'll say it one more time. The Big Change Program is leaving the station on January 14th. If you're interested, don't let it leave without you. It's really good. I haven't been good about collecting testimonials yet because, you know, we're only halfway through the first one. We're not quite 6 months in, and I'm reluctant to have people tell me how great it is when they haven't gone through the whole thing. But people do really appreciate the group and Josh and the structure and the way it's so supportive and clear and giving people, really taking away hope and giving people control. Like, people come in saying, I hope that I can change. And after a while, they realize how disempowering that language is, and they just go do. And just as I was influenced and inspired and motivated and slapped upside the head by Josh Lajani, so now the Big Change Program allows lots of people to have that same transformative experience and connection with him and with me. That's all for this week. As always, be well, my friends.